Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zato. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest form, CQ magazine for November 2008. CQ is published by Richard A. Ross. His call is K2MGA. The editor is Richard S. Mawson, W2VU. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hemp may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Let's start right out with the editorial page. It's called Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by Rich Mawson, W2VU. He titles this one, Connections. Ham radio, in my mind, is all about connections, whether they be physical connections of components and wires on a circuit board, the ethereal connections of contacts on the air, or the personal connections of lasting friendships made through our radio hobby. The strength and durability of these connections determines the strength and durability of the hobby itself. A few illustrations. The main event. And it's spelled like the state of Maine, M-A-I-N-E. While on vacation last summer, I was on a repeater in southern Maine that was part of a linked system covering most of the state. I made a random contact with another ham on another one of the repeaters in the system. In the course of our QSO, this ham mentioned that he was on his way to visit his son in a small town in central Maine. The name of the town rang a bell with me. A ham friend of mine, who worked at the same television network I did before joining CQ, had had a summer house there. I hadn't seen or talked with my friend in nearly 20 years, and had even forgotten his call sign, although I did remember his name. I had no idea whether my friend was still there, or even still here. Knowing that the odds were remote, I explained the situation, asked the ham if he or his son possibly knew this gentleman. He said that he didn't, and that his son wasn't a ham, but that he would check with him when he arrived. That's when the fun began. Another station broke in, said he knew my friend, that he was still in Maine and had been one of his first contacts after he got his license. At that point, two other stations broke in. The first said, "Well, I just drove past the diner where your friend often eats breakfast, but I don't see his car there. I talk to him pretty frequently, though, and I'll be happy to give him your regards." The second station simply asked, "Would you like me to call him?" A few miles further up the road, my cell phone rang. My friend and I were reconnected, only in ham radio. The story isn't quite over. Later that evening, while sitting on top of Cadillac Mountain outside of Bar Harbor, a couple of hundred miles from that first repeater, I got onto a different repeater on the link system and ran into the same ham on his way home from his son's house. I was able to fill him in on the day's events and complete the circuit. The piece has another subtitle, Saying Goodbye. Another type of connection in ham radio is the link we feel with people who paved the way for us in the hobby, both those we know personally and those public representatives of the hobby whom we feel we know, even though we've never met. We've lost two of these public hams in the past month. Popular Communications, that's a title. Founding editor, Tommy Knittle, K4XAA, XK2AES. And former CQ technical editor Irv Tepper, XWB2FUZ. Tommy was a fixture in the radio hobby for nearly a half century, particularly in the shortwave listening and scanning arenas. You can see his obituary in last month's news section. As a columnist for Popular Electronics back in the 1960s, Tommy started the WPE program for registered shortwave listeners. I remember being one of them. My first, albeit unofficial, call sign was WPE2RIY. Tommy moved on to edit S9 magazine, and in 1982, he and CQ publisher Dick Ross, K2MGA, launched our sister publication, Popular Communications. Tommy was its editor until his retirement in 1995. I never met Tommy in person, but still feel the connection. He left an indelible mark on the radio hobby and will be sorely missed. Irv Tepper served as CQ's technical editor for 11 years, starting out without a ham license and eventually becoming WB2FUZ. Irv was primarily a teacher. He taught at the George Westinghouse Vocational Tech High School in Brooklyn, New York, for many years and wrote a curriculum for the state of New York. Of course, part of his job as CQ's technical editor was to be a teacher as well, making sure everything was not only technically correct, but clearly explained. Irv was also the author of several books on electronics. He became a silent key on August 31. While Irv most directly touched his family, friends, students, and those with whom he worked at CQ, he indirectly touched anyone who read this magazine between 1960 and 1971, and who learned even a little from our resident electronics teacher. It's another one of those connections, those links between past and present, and among hams. A subsection titled Saying Hello. While we say goodbye to Tommy and Irv, we also make a new connection, saying hello to Brittany Decker, KB1OGL, CQ's new youth editor. Brittany is 14 years old, holds a general class license, and has already had two articles published in CQ, most recently last month's, titled A Rookie's Guide to Contesting. I believe we read that one for you on the digest format, folks. Starting with next month, she will be writing a quarterly column by, about, and for young hams and other young people thinking about becoming hams. Welcome aboard, Brittany. You are joining a conversation, a connection between CQ's writers and readers that has been going on nonstop for nearly 65 years. We hope you can help bring along the next generation to join that conversation. We are also pleased to announce the return after a many years absence of CQ logo shirts, hats, etc., which will be available either personalized or in a generic format. See our holiday ad on page 72 of the November issue here for details. And speaking of holidays, all the best from all of us at CQ for a very happy Thanksgiving. The editor finishes up with a clarification comment. One sentence in my October editorial may have given some people the mistaken impression that one needs to be a computer programmer in order to use or contribute to software development for the Flex Radio FLEX5000 transceiver. I am told by the folks at Flex that no special skills are required to operate a Flex 5000, that you simply load the driver and power SDR software and begin operating. In addition, they say actual programmers are a small minority in their user base, and that participants in the collaborative process that leads to new features, enhancements, and whatever, range from those with no programming skills whatsoever to those few real live programmers. 73. Rick Mawson, W2VU. It's time to take a peek at ham radio news. August sunspots, zero, zilch, nada, none, maybe. Various solar sources, including the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Space Weather Prediction Center, reported seeing zero sunspots in the month of August. This, according to the DailyTech.com website, is the first time that has happened since 1913. The Brussels International Sunspot number, however, was 0.5. How do you have half a sunspot? According to spaceweather.com, there were two instances during August in which a sunspot tried unsuccessfully to reach the sun's surface. Apparently, in some quarters, effort counts for something. There was some encouraging news in late September. On the 22nd, spaceweather.com reported, quoting, "For the first time in months, a significant sunspot is emerging on the sun. It is a fast-growing active region with two dark cores, each larger than Earth. The magnetic polarity of the sunspot identifies it as a member of New Sunspot Cycle 24. Because the year 2008 has brought so many blank suns, some observers have wondered if we are ever going to climb out of the ongoing deep solar minimum. Today's new sunspot is an encouraging sign that the 11-year solar cycle is indeed progressing, albeit slowly." Richard Garriott at W5KWQ heads for a space station. Video game designer, programmer Richard Garriott at W5KWQ was scheduled to become the sixth high-paying private citizen to vacation on the International Space Station. Garriott, whose father Owen Garriott, called W5LFL, was the first person to operate ham radio from space 25 years ago, is planning to make contact with a dozen school groups during his trip from October 12th through the 22nd. In addition, he is planning to make random contacts with scout groups during the annual Jamboree on the Air on October 18-19, and to contact his dad by ham radio, according to a joint news release from ARRL and AMSAT. Garriott is also reportedly bringing along slow-scan TV equipment so that he can transmit still pictures from the space station during his school contacts. The school contacts are being coordinated through ARISS, A-R-I-S-S, Amateur Radio on the International Space Station. Garriott is scheduled to fly to and from the ISS on a Russian Soyuz capsule. The chip turns 50. The invention that laid the groundwork for our electronic society is now 50 years old. On September 12, 1958, Texas Instruments engineer Jack Kilby successfully demonstrated the first integrated circuit, which had transistors and other components etched on to a slice of germanium. The first successful commercial product utilizing an IC was Texas Instruments' first handheld electronic calculator, of which Kilby was a co-inventor. The introduction of the chip led to the development of personal computers, cell phones, and the myriad other electronic devices which today seem to permeate our lives. Kilby died in 2005. To mark the 50th anniversary of his life-changing invention, Texas Instruments on December 12 opened the new Kilby Labs in Dallas. The new center will bring together university researchers and top TI engineers to work on new advances in chip technology. A little bit of news from the ARRL, American Radio Relay League, seeks to double size of the 500 kilohertz experiment. The ARRL has petitioned the FCC to expand from 20 to 40 the number of stations permitted to participate in its experimental license on 500 kilohertz. According to the ARRL letter, the league says expanding participation will provide greater geographic coverage, including Alaska and Hawaii, and will provide more opportunities for ground wave testing. The petition also includes requests for more frequencies, 495 through 510 kilohertz, and permission for portable operation within 50 kilometers of the station's authorized fixed location. Now in the category of batteries, who needs batteries? Researchers at the University of Texas in Austin have developed a new material that they say can double the energy storage capacities of ultracapacitors. According to this title, Science Daily, the electrically conductive material is called graphene, that's G-R-A-P-H-E-N-E. It's called graphene, and it can be produced in sheets that are one atom thick. In principle, the researchers say the entire surface of a graphene sheet can be in contact with the electrolyte of an ultracapacitor, suggesting it can hold double the charge of existing ultracapacitors. Like any capacitor, an ultracapacitor can store and later release electrical energy. The researchers hope their discovery will make solar and wind power more affordable and practical by increasing the amount of energy that can be stored for use when it is dark or not windy. Meanwhile, researchers at MIT and other locations are working on devices that use magnetic fields to wirelessly transmit electrical power to wireless devices. This, according to a report in the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger, opens up the possibility that you could power or charge a device such as a cell phone, iPod, or even HT simply by placing it within the magnetic field of the power source. So far, the article says, wireless power transmissions have succeeded over a range of about 1 foot. Finally, on the power front, a group of hams in Ohio reportedly use fuel cells provided by Ultracell Corporation to power its mobile rigs and handhelds while providing communications for the United States Air Force Marathon September 20th in Dayton. Well, we have one more radio ham news piece here. Might be of particular interest to you shortwave listeners. Radio Netherlands ends North American shortwave service. For the past 60 years, Radio Netherlands Worldwide has been one of the early catches for thousands of shortwave listeners in the United States and Canada. No longer. As of October 26, Radio Netherlands announced it is terminating its shortwave broadcast to North America. The decision was based on declining radio listenership as well as a number of other ways to access the station's programming, including the World Wide Web, satellite transmission, and partnerships with the North American broadcasters, including the CBC in Canada, and many national public radio stations in the United States. In a statement, Radio Netherlands' Andy Clark wrote, "We believe that shortwave is still an effective means of reaching listeners in regions where there are fewer alternatives. Radio Netherlands Worldwide will now concentrate its English shortwave broadcast to South Asia and Africa." Additional and updated news is available on the Ham Radio News page of CQ website at http://www.cq-amateur-radio.com. For breaking news stories plus info on additional items of interest, you can sign up for CQ's free online newsletter service. Just click on CQ Newsletter on the homepage of our website. Again, that website is www.cq-amateur-radio.com. One of our first pieces here in the magazine for November 2008 is a CQ Reviews, the Elecraft K3 transceiver. There are two authors with this article, Bob Loescher, W9KNI, and Rick Tavan, NX6I. The review is quite lengthy and very, very specific. I'll give you some summary information on it, though. Elecraft has earned a significant niche in the amateur radio marketplace with its full-featured kits for both QRP, that's low power, and medium power operation. The K3, Kilo 3, sets a new benchmark for the company, as explained in this two-author review in which each brings to the table a slightly different perspective. The two-authored article has a summary as follows. The K3 is a state-of-the-art all-purpose HF plus 6-meter transceiver that meets or beats all competition. The feature set is rich and powerful, with most of the bells and whistles that a competitive operator needs, and many others that the newer operator insists on. The online user community, CUM support group, is outstanding. The Elecraft people listen well and act on input from the field. The K3 is a class act from a solid company, a joy to own and operate. There's an article here by Tom Pereira called W1TP. Ham radio returns to World War II. World War II reenactments are gaining in popularity, and hams are often part of the show, demonstrating and communicating with authentic World War II military radios. W1PT takes us inside one of these events as we mark Veterans Day in this November issue. World War II put thousands of hams in uniform. They served in every corner of the world in every imaginable capacity. They were assigned duties ranging from the operation of military radio stations to repair of equipment, and some never saw radar during the entire war. The spirit of ham radio was alive and well in most unlikely places. A troop ship carrying thousands of soldiers to Europe was showing a movie on deck to keep the troops entertained. When the projector operator stopped the show to change film reels, the screen went dark. One ham in the audience pulled out his flashlight and flashed CQ and his call signs in Morse code on the screen. He was immediately answered by the flashlights of several other hams, and they spent the rest of the voyage getting to know each other and talking ham radio. 63 years after the end of World War II, ham radio operators are still involved in World War II military operations. Dozens of annual World War II reenactments take place throughout the world. Hams participate by creating authentic World War II radio stations and by operating the authentic period radio equipment. One of the largest of the World War II reenactments takes place at the Reading, Pennsylvania Airport each year in early June. It is run by the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum, whose website, which is www.maam.org/maamwwii.html, gives the latest information and schedule. At the Reading reenactment, over 1,500 authentically dressed reenactors portray American, British, Australian, German, Japanese, and Spanish soldiers and officers. They set up authentic encampments, cook their own food in authentic field kitchens, and drive authentic vehicles ranging from motorcycles to jeeps to half-tracks and tanks. Every few hours, a major battle takes place, with the reenactors shooting blank cartridge-firing machine guns, artillery firing huge charges of black powder, and overflights and dogfights by authentic period aircraft. Lectures by notable World War II figures, flamethrower and weapons demonstrations, and flights aboard World War II bombers are scheduled throughout the day. In the evenings, big band era music, Abbott and Costello's impersonators, and the Franklin D. Roosevelt look-alike entertain a crowd that totals about 30,000. It is total immersion in the culture and events of World War II. Ham radio operators in many of the reenactment groups set up radio stations and communicate with other groups on the standard 75-meter AM phone frequency of 3885 megahertz. This is the frequency to which most of the crystal-controlled radios and walkie-talkies were tuned during the war. Remember, ham radio was shut down during World War II. It has become the standard frequency for use at reenactments and at the many ham fests where military radio enthusiasts set up military radio stations. Hams buy absolutely authentic uniforms, tents, and radio equipment and display and operate them at these meets. They attend these meets in all kinds of weather and often spend 3 days sleeping on authentically uncomfortable cots inside leaky tents and eating food cooked over open fires in authentic garbage cans. You know, I even recall some of that, folks. I hate to tell you. Maybe it sort of signals my age, huh? They all love to demonstrate and explain to the public how military radios were used during the war. Their demonstrations also introduce visitors to ham radio. They welcome thousands of visitors into their tents and patiently explain and demonstrate how the radio equipment worked by making contact with other ham-operated military stations at the meet or elsewhere. Some also go to the shows to honor and feel closer to parents and relatives who were in the war. I'll stop the article there, folks. It goes on for several more pages, but it's very nicely written, and there are a lot of full-color photographs accompanying the text material here. If you're interested in it, it begins on page 26 and concludes somewhere, I believe, on page 30. So that's in the November 2008 CQ magazine. Hey, there's an announcement here. I would be remiss if I didn't put it in for the magazine, of course. The 2009 CQ Worldwide 160-meter contest. The CW, or Morse code portion, is 2200 Zulu, January 23 to 2200 Zulu, January 25. The single sideband voice, 2200 Zulu, February 27 to 2200 Zulu, March 1. It says, please note, this year's rules reflect several significant changes, so please read them closely. Here is a summary of the major changes. 1. The dates for the 2009 single sideband contest are a week later than usual to avoid conflict with the ARRLDX contest. This is a calendar anomaly and will return to the last full weekend in February in the year 2010. Number 2, the start and end times of the contest have been shifted 2 hours earlier in response to requests from the 160 contesting community. 3, the exchange for DX stations has been changed from RS, T in parenthesis, and country to RS, T in parenthesis, and CQ zone. 4, a new single operator assisted class has been added to permit the use of clusters, skimmers, etc. 5, a 40-hour maximum operating period has been added for multi-op entries. 6, provisions have been added regarding remote operation. The 2009 CQ Worldwide 160-meter contest, January for the CW, February for the single sideband. Now, for those of you who like to read still, even the elderly folks who may have time on their hands that don't always play with radios or watch television or listen to music, CQ has for you a book review, The Old Timer, 60 Years in the Hobby of Amateur Radio, from the years 1947 through 2007. The author is James B. Smith, a Canadian call sign, VK9NS, Victor Kilo 9, November Sierra. The book is reviewed by James D. Kane, K1TN. How fortunate we are to have Jim Smith, VK9NS, write an amateur radio-based memoir. With his life of world travel, his amateur radio exploits, and his flair for writing, he certainly has the creds for the job. The number of amateur radio memoirs published can be counted on one hand, as far as I know. Too many candidates have died without leaving a word, and more of the World War II generation is leaving us every day. This is a tremendous loss to us, and all the more reason to be grateful to Smith for his effort. Born in 1928 in Scotland, Jim Smith was too young to enlist in World War II. He says little about his early life in the book, except that his father and his father's sisters and brothers inherited a considerable sum of money. That was in quotes. Smith describes home life as the war dragged on as not exactly wonderful. Radio had sparked his interest as a teenager, and at age 17, Smith joined the Royal Air Force to train as a radio technician. After assignments in the Far East, where he learned Morse code and was first licensed as VS1BQ, Singapore, Smith and his first wife, Jean, were posted in Germany from 1952 to 1957, then lived in England until 1973. Jean held several DX calls. Smith made the DXCC honor roll as G3HSR. Through this part of the book, the reader is treated to part travelogue and part amateur radio stories and personalities, and this takes us through just 90 pages. After four children and 23 years of marriage, Jim and Jean Smith split up. Jim spent half a dozen years batching it, B-A-T-C-H-I-N-G it, whatever that means. Then on his first visit to Norfolk Island and operation as VK9NS, he fortuitously met a slightly younger woman named Chrissy. K-I-R-S-T-I. Christy, I guess it is. Christy is a ham, too, VK9NL. They are married, and she wrote a book of her own about their de-expedition to Heard Island. Now, sadly, that book is out of print. This book, titled The Old Timer, transports us not only to the Far East, but all over the Pacific and Antarctic Islands, and in the 1990s to Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, and even the Andaman Islands. The book is loaded with photos conveniently arranged together at the end of each chapter. I found myself turning to the photos first, then reading the chapter, then looking at the photos all over again. Incidentally, when I sat down to begin reading the book, I planned to read just a couple of chapters, but ended up reading 250 pages. Smith spent 11 years in the RAF before striking out as sort of a freelance aviation electronics tech and troubleshooter. He was licensed in Papua New Guinea as a P-29JS before moving to Norfolk Island, where he has lived since 1980. The exes who go back to the 80s will remember the 14220 net, Smith's baby, as well as the Heard Island DX Association, which raised money to support the number of expeditions by Smith and others. DXing has always been amateur radio's hotbed of rumor, innuendo, personality conflicts, accusations, and even the occasional lawsuit. However, there is little mention of any of that in The Old Timer. This reviewer would have liked some of that dirt, but in the end I was touched by Smith's writing about the positive influence amateur radio has had during the course of his life so far. I also was struck by the similarities between Smith and three other DX legends. Danny Wheel, VP2VB, Iris Colvin, W6QL, and Lloyd Colvin, W6KG. Too many connections to try to enumerate here. Maybe there is some sort of gene at work. All four became members of the CQDX Hall of Fame. Book publishing has always been a brutal business, and it's worse than ever today. The Old Timer is available both in print and on a CD-ROM at half the print price. The print version mercifully features text in large, dense type for us old timers. At this writing, Jim Smith and Christy Jenkins Smith still live on Norfolk Island. Jim just marked his 80th birthday in October 2008 and is an active member of the Collins Collectors Association. Jim and Christy's website is www.jimkirsti.com. Again, the book was about The Old Timer by James B. Smith, amateur call VK9NS. I'll be going now to Washington Readout by Frederick O. Maia. He spells that M-A-I-A. Frederick's call is W5YI. It's titled Early History of Two-Way Radio Communications. Begins on page 54. Amateur radio began with a few experimenters in the early 1900s. It has since grown to over 650,000 licensed operators in the United States. There are more than 2 million licensed hams worldwide. In the United States, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, and Communications Act of 1934, the document that created this independent governmental agency, and the Code Federal Regulations, CFR, provide the guidelines under which the amateur radio service is regulated. The CFR is organized into various titles, parts, subparts, and sections. Title 47 applies to telecommunications, and Part 97 applies to the amateur radio service. Since radio waves do not respect international borders, domestic communications policy cannot be developed without regard to international implications. The Commission is required to regulate wire and radio communications within the guidelines of international telecommunication agreements, of which the United States is a part. Now, regarding the early days of communications, the earliest method of distant communication was by runner, and later by riders, who carried oral or written messages. Next came various forms of manual binary signaling. Binary signaling is defined as the presence or absence of a single element that, when used in prearranged combinations, conveys intelligence. The earliest versions were audible or visual systems, signal fires, reflected sunlight, smoke screens, flag waving, and jungle drums are early examples of binary signaling. Communication over electric wires arrived in 1835 when Samuel F. B. Morse, his lifespan was 1791 through 1872, an art professor at New York University, employed a chemical battery and a level to send currents through a wire circuit. The discovery of the ground return circuit meant that only one wire would be needed. The word telegraph was coined to mean a device that could print patterns at a distance. It was derived from the Greek tele, that's T-E-L-E, which means far, F-A-R, and graphene, G-R-A-P-H-E-I-N, which means to write. Morse gave his first public demonstration of the electric telegraph in 1838. However, it was not until 5 years later that Congress appropriated $30,000 so Morse could construct an experimental telegraph line from Washington to Baltimore. The original Morse machine printed code on tape using pulses of current to deflect an electromagnet, which moved a marker to produce written codes on a strip of paper. Morse later developed a key and sounder, since he discovered that the code could better be received by ear, thereby eliminating the printer. Samuel Morse ushered in the age of electrical communications by sending his first "What hath God wrought?" message on May 24, 1844, from the old Supreme Court chamber in the United States Capitol to his partner, Alfred Vail, in Baltimore, a distance of 40 miles. 3 days later, the Democratic National Convention was held in Baltimore. Martin Van Buren was considered a likely choice, but James K. Polk was nominated. When this news was telegraphed to Washington, skeptics refused to believe it. Only after people arriving by train from Baltimore confirmed the report were many convinced of the telegraph's value. Morse and his associates obtained private funds to extend their line to Philadelphia and New York. Small telegraph lines sprung up in the East, South, and Midwest. Dispatching trains by telegraph began in 1851. The Western Union Telegraph Company began business offering telegrams that same year. Western Union built the first transcontinental telegraph line in 1861, mainly along railroad right-of-ways. It introduced the first stock ticker in 1866, a standardized time service in 1870, and money transfer in 1871. Telegrams were most popular in the 1920s and 30s, when they were cheaper than a long-distance call. However, the telephone and email eventually led to the extinction of the telegram. After more than 150 years of service, Western Union discontinued telegrams in February 2006. By 1859, both the railroad and the telegraph had reached the town of St. Joseph, Missouri. 2,000 miles farther west and still unconnected was California. The only transportation to California was by stagecoach, a 60-day journey. To establish quicker communications with California, the Pony Express mail route was organized. By 1869, the Pony Express was replaced by the telegraph, which now had lines all the way to San Francisco. And now more about that wireless telegraph. The telegraph provided speedy communication at the time the West was open. Together with the railroad, the telegraph built up communications, opened markets, and promoted commerce. A good Morse operator could transmit 40 to 50 words per minute. Within 10 years, the tentacles of the electric telegraph had spread to England and Europe. Telegraph communications became the rage. In an instant, it could cover distances that took stagecoaches, Pony Express riders, or locomotives days, or even weeks to span. In 1850, when countries in Europe adopted a new version of the American Morse code, which they called the Continental or International Morse, the new code eliminated the characters using close space dots and replaced them with DAs, which required long key closure. Nations everywhere began establishing telegraphic networks within their boundaries. There were problems, however. Telegraph lines did not cross national frontiers, and technical and operating standards varied widely from country to country. Many used a completely different system to safeguard the secrecy of its military and political communications. That meant messages had to be transcribed, translated, and physically handed over at national borders before being retransmitted over the telegraph network of the neighboring country. The International Telegraph Union, ITU, was formed in Paris on May 17, 1865, when 20 European nations met to work out an international agreement to interconnect their national networks. The ITU thus became the world's first international coordinating body. The second, convened on September 15, 1874, was a Universal Postal Union. Both had similar obstacles since the mail and telegraph lines had to cross national borders. The ITU decided on standardizing equipment and operating rules to guarantee interconnection to the European telegraph network and to use the international version of the Morse alphabet. It was also agreed that the organization would serve as a meeting place for future amendments. This marked the birth of the ITU, which changed its name from International Telegraph Union to International Telecommunication Union in 1932. Today, more than 140 years later, the factors which led to the formation of the Union still apply, and the fundamental goals of the ITU are basically the same. Now we come to the discovery of radio. There is a controversy as to who actually discovered radio, a word coined from the verb radiate. In the 1860s, a Scottish scientist by the name of James Clerk Maxwell predicted the existence of radio waves. In 1866, Heinrich Hertz, a German physicist, demonstrated that rapid variations of electrical current could be projected into space in the form of radio waves similar to those of light and heat. Guglielmo Marconi, years 1874 through 1937, was generally credited as the inventor of the two-wave radio. Marconi, a young Italian inventor, proved that communication by radio was possible in 1889. He had read how Heinrich Hertz conducted a series of experiments in Germany that proved the existence of radio waves. Hertz credited and radiated electromagnetic waves using a battery-operated induction coil connected to a spark gap. Marconi reasoned, why not use the waves for signaling? Marconi sent and received his first radio signal locally in Italy in 1895. In 1899, he successfully sent wireless communications across the English Channel. In early 1900, Marconi developed and patented a tuned receiver and transmitter system. And on December 12, 1901, he transmitted the first radio signals across the Atlantic Ocean. He sent the Morse letter S, did-did-did, from Puthoe, Cornwall, England, to Signal Hill at St. John's, Newfoundland. The antenna was a wire hanging from a kite. Up until then, all telegraph networks stopped at the edge of the Great Seas. Marconi also sent the first eastward transatlantic radio telegraph message in 1902. The era of the amateur radio experimenter had begun. The Russians have a different view. They believe that Alexander Popov, a Russian scientist, discovered radio a year before Marconi began his experiments. In fact, each year, on May 7, Russia celebrates Radio Day to commemorate Popov's achievements. History shows, however, that his device was basically a receiver and antenna for the detection of natural electrical waves, lightning. Popov actually wanted to be able to predict the arrival of thunderstorms in advance. Now, as regards maritime radio, Marconi's activities aroused world interest. Sea disasters proved the new medium, radio, to be an effective aid in rescue work as well as for communicating between ships and shore points, and a number of ocean liners installed wireless equipment. At the request of Germany, a conference was convened in Berlin in 1903 to establish international radio cooperation and standardization. The new technique, the radio telegraph, held great promise for maritime communications. A new common distress call was considered, as well as a system to provide for wireless communication between ships and ship to shore. The first wireless distress frequency was set at 500 kilohertz for ships to use to call for help. An agreement governing wireless telegraphy was signed at the International Radio Telegraph Conference held in 1906, and another communications organization was formed, the International Radio Telegraph Union, IRU. The conference also agreed to require ships to be equipped with wireless transmitters and receivers. Before the turn of the century, there was no special radio telegraph called for emergencies at sea. One pioneer operator helped send the letters spelling H-E-L-P in code. In 1903, Italy suggested S-S-S-D-D-D as an international radio emergency call. A year later, land telegraphy operators recruited for sea duty resorted to the general C-Q call and added the letter D to signify distress. International agreement was reached in 1906, and SOS was adopted as the worldwide radio telegraph distress call. It replaced the CQD radio distress call, which meant anyone answer, that's the CQ part. I am in distress, the D part of distress. SOS does not mean save our souls any more than CQD meant come quick danger. Think about that, folks. In early years, wireless telegraphy remained confined mostly to the sea. In 1899, however, the U.S. Army began using wireless, and 2 years later, the Navy replaced its visual signaling and homing pigeons with a wireless system. In 1906, the U.S. Weather Bureau experimented with radio telegraphy to speed up the reporting of weather conditions. During World War I, governments began using radio telegraph to keep abreast of events and to direct the movement of troops and supplies. The first U.S. legislation dealing with marine radio was approved by Congress in 1910. Known as the Wireless Ship Act, it required installation of wireless apparatus and operators on large seagoing passenger vessels. In 1912, Congress amended the act to cover large cargo vessels. Only a few ships staffed their radio equipment around the clock. That all changed after April 15, 1912, when the Titanic, ripped open by an iceberg, sank in the North Atlantic. The Titanic's radio operator frantically called for help over the wireless, but the wireless operator on the nearest ship had gone to bed with no one to take his place. Another ship, the Carpathia, 58 miles away, responded and managed to rescue 868 of the nearly 2,400 people on board. As a result of the sinking of the Titanic, the IRU convened the International Radio Telegraph Conference in London to further wireless uniformity. It was agreed to establish a system that still governs spectrum use to this day. The radio spectrum was divided into bands, the use of which would be reserved for specific purposes. Regulations were enacted to require at least two radio operators on ships and a constant watch with emergency backup power supplies. The International Frequency Registration Board, IFRB, was set up to manage the frequency spectrum, which was becoming increasingly congested. Each nation committed to avoid interference to existing wireless stations and to register their own use of radio frequencies. The first table of frequency allocations became mandatory in 1912. These first regulations have since been amended and revised by numerous radio conferences and are now known as the International Radio Regulations. Early regulation of radio. To carry out its obligations under the treaty, the United States enacted the Radio Act of 1912. This was the first law for the domestic control of radio communication. The Radio Act regulated the character of emissions, transmission of distress calls, set aside certain frequencies for government use, and placed licensing of wireless stations and operators under the Secretary of Commerce and Labor. It was pushed through Congress and signed into law by President Taft on August 17, 1912. Radio station and operator licensing began that year, making access to the electromagnetic spectrum a privilege granted only by government approval. At the time, unlicensed amateur stations accounted for 80% of all stations on the air. Amateurs were free to assign themselves call signs and set up stations wherever they wished. A typical amateur station consisted of an induction coil, a condenser, and spark gap for the transmitter, and a simple coherer, decoherer, or galena crystal for the receive detector. Chaos ruled the airwaves, with everyone transmitting on the same wavelength. A key question for the early regulators was what to do about the amateur radio operators. Legislators decided that instead of abolishing amateur radio stations, they would limit their operation to the supposedly worthless short waves. Regulation 15th banished radio amateurs to the experimental frequencies above 200 meters and limited transmitter power to a kilowatt. That's 1,000 watts, folks. That's a lot of juice. The lawmakers had come up with a regulation that would finally keep the ham operator off the lower frequencies that were being used more and more for commercial, maritime, and government use. Little did anyone know that the useless short waves would ultimately become the most valuable of the entire radio spectrum for long-distance communication. That was left for the hams to discover. Amateurs also pioneered sound broadcasting in 1920. At the Telegraph Union's 1927 Washington Conference, it allocated frequency bands to the various radio services existing at the time, fixed, maritime, aeronautical, mobile, broadcasting, amateur, and experimental. Operating guidelines for each of these stations and operator qualifications were established. It was deemed important that amateurs prove an ability to transmit and receive in Morse code. In 1947, at Atlantic City, the ITU agreed that Morse proficiency should only be required of amateur operators when the operation took place on frequencies below 1,000 megahertz. That's 1 gigahertz. At the WARC, WARC 59 conference, the 1959 World Administrative Radio Conference, this level was dropped to 144 megahertz. A further reduction was made at the WARC 79 to 30 megahertz. Finally, at WARC 2003, the Morse proficiency requirements in the amateur service was made optional. Now we're getting down to how the ARRL got started, the American Radio Relay League. In 1914, a Connecticut engineer and inventor by the name of Hiram Percy Maxim wanted to obtain a new Audion radio vacuum tube. Maxim, a member of the Radio Club of Hartford, Connecticut, heard that a Springfield, Massachusetts operator had one for sale. That's not far from Hartford, folks, Springfield. However, Maxim was unable to raise Springfield. He solved the problem by calling Windsor Locks, Connecticut, and requested his message be relayed to Springfield. Remember, folks, geography-wise, we're talking maybe 25 miles. For many months, Maxim had felt the need for a national amateur radio organization, just as he had felt the need for a local club in Hartford. The relay idea represented an ideal basis for the needed national organization. Maxim even thought of a name for his organization, the American Radio Relay League. Today, few radio amateurs realize that HAM, H-A-M, radio nearly ended with World War I, or Maxim's role in saving it. The fate of amateur radio, silenced by the war from 1917 to 1919, was in the balance in the days immediately following the signing of the armistice. The government, having had a taste of supreme authority over communications in wartime, was more than half inclined to keep it. The war had not ended a month before Congress was considering legislation that would have made it impossible for the amateur radio of old to be resumed. At the pleadings of the ARRL's Hiram Maxim, the bill that would have ended amateur radio for all time was defeated. On October 1, 1919, the wartime ban on amateur radio was lifted, and ham radio continues today as the only hobby regulated by international treaty and government regulations. That completes the article, folks. Rather lengthy, but I enjoy these full fact historical kind of commentaries. I hope I didn't bore you with it. The title of this article is Early History of Two-Way Radio Communications. The author is Frederick O. Mayer. That's called W5YI. We thank Fred very much for that very well put together piece of history about radio. Folks, I'm going to conclude with just a short piece here. It's titled Bringing Wireless to Wireless. Is there a manufacturer ready to fully integrate wireless technology, such as Bluetooth, with a remotely mounted transceiver? Today's newer vehicles beg for a transceiver that can be mounted remotely, perhaps even under the hood or in the trunk of a vehicle close to the battery. This ideal transceiver would communicate via wireless with its remote control display, wireless speaker, and wireless microphone, perhaps similar to the increasingly popular integrated ear headsets used by cell phone operators. It's clear the trend will be towards smaller, fuel, and space-efficient vehicles that seek to maximize interior space in a smaller package, which means less room for aftermarket accessories. I recently changed cars, and it took two people several hours to remove two transceivers, a VHF-UHF tri-band and a high-frequency plus 6 unit with antennas from my old car. It occurred to me as we worked removing vehicle trim, the seats, control cables, power cables, speaker leads, and coax that there has to be an easier, more modern approach to installing and enjoying amateur radio gear in a contemporary car. I believe a modular wireless approach would have strong appeal to hams who would like to integrate their hobby with mobile operations without having to tear the car apart and risk voiding the new vehicle warranty. The technology exists. Can any manufacturer rise to the challenge? The author here is Jeff Reinhardt, R-E-I-N-H-A-R-D-T. His call is AA6JR, Alpha Alpha 6 Juliet Romeo. You can email him at his call, AA6JR, at CQ-amateur-radio.com. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob, your reader. My call again is N1BLF, November 1 Bravo Lima Foxtrot. QTH is Dartmouth, Mass. We're right on Buzzards Bay, good old Cape Cod, about 50 miles south of Boston. It's my pleasure to be reading CQ Magazine in digest form for the members of the Courage Handy Hemp System and any of those other people who might pick it up on different websites. I want to wish all of you a very happy holiday season. We're dealing with a November issue, and it's already November the 15th, so it's a little bit behind the curve. I hope they do better with the mailings next time. And until we meet again, I wish you a happy holiday season. I've been reading from the CQ magazine for November 2008. The publisher is Richard A. Ross, K2MGA. Recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It's for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. A great website, too, at www.handyham.org. 73 N1BLF.